Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Inside the Asperger Studios. Are you in a relationship and you feel like it's going toxic? Do you not know what the red flags are before you even get into a relationship? Or you are in one and you're seeing those red flags now? Well, me and my next guest, Laura, talk about just that, knowing what the red flags are, what to do about it, and how to deal with everything else that comes after. So sit back, relax, and grab your favorite beverage, and I'll see you on the other side. See you there. Hello and welcome to a Saturday edition of Inside the Asperger Studios. Today I'm joined with Laura Sweeney again, where we're going to talk about relationships and dating those of us who are on the spectrum and the troubles we face. Welcome back, Laura.
Hi, Reed. How's it going? Thank you so much for having me.
Not a problem. So where do you see the troubles when we want to get into a relationship with someone who's an NT and vice versa?
Sure. I think it's interesting because I think we run into trouble with the truth is we want relationships. I think most of us, I mean, I say I'm going to speak for myself here and others' mileage may vary, but I don't want to kind of come off as I'm trying to speak for everybody because I know everybody's different. But I think that I like relationships. I like to form them. And by relationships, I mean, not just romantic ones, but friendships too. It's like, I want to be social. It's just that I don't quite have all of the wiring in me that helps me understand why, you know, how other people tick, what makes certain people do what they do, say what they say, what are the societal rules, what are the yardsticks by which we're measured, that sort of thing. So I kind of have a lack of understanding when it comes to that. And so relationships are very much like that too. I mean, all my life, people have flirted with me and I didn't even know they were flirting. You know, my mom, I remember being a teenager in my late teens and my mom, she'd be like, "Hey, that guy likes you." I'm like, "Really?" I couldn't tell. And I didn't even know I was on the spectrum and I wouldn't know for like another 20 years. But I mean, I only found out about 6-ish years ago. And yeah, about that. And so my mom, she would always say, "Hey, you know, that guy likes you," or, "He's looking at you." And I'd be like, "Wait, what?" And there were people, my sister came to me, you know, at some point and he said, "Yeah, that guy that traveled with us all summer and worked with us, he was like smitten with you. He had a crush on you." I'm like, "Why didn't anybody tell me this?" Because I had no idea. I even struggled to remember who that guy was. And I was like, "Wow." And I felt so bad. I was like embarrassed. I was like, "Oh shoot." You know, and I hope he didn't take it as though I were brushing him off or ghosting him or something. I literally didn't know. It's like, I barely knew he was alive. And so I felt so bad. So I think it really just kind of comes down to, we're wired differently. We tend to think that different things are important. You know, we tend not to really, you know, dating apps are kind of a nightmare because people list certain things, you know, their income or whatever. And I'm just like, I kind of don't care. Like, as long as they can support themselves and contribute to the partnership, then I'm cool with it. You know, people, you know, status symbols, you know, driving luxury cars and stuff. And it's like, that doesn't matter to me. And I don't understand how it matters to so many people because it's something so trivial and it so lacks the ability to describe what's inside that person. I'm more interested in what's inside, but I do have trouble reading what's inside people sometimes because, for example, I might, you know, I say things literally, you know, I say I'm very straightforward. And someone else might actually be like trying to give me a hint or maybe some criticism or something. But they're trying to be diplomatic about it. But if they don't come out and say it, then I might not pick up on it. I'm not going to get the hint. I'm not going to understand what that someone's criticizing me. And so I won't have any opportunity to change what I'm doing. So I think that's where we run into trouble, because other people then assume that we're dense or stupid in some way, or disabled, mm-hmm. or weird, or something like that. And it's like, no, it's just, I didn't pick up on the cues because they weren't obvious. It's not what I would have done. You know, I mean, I like to be clear with people. And apparently that's not the way society works. Society doesn't really like clarity as much as they like diplomacy. And I understand diplomacy. I understand, mm-hmm. okay, if you're going to say something to someone, be nice, you mm-hmm. know, kind of take those raw words and put them through a filter before saying them. But that's an extra step I have to consciously take. Whereas a neurotypical, they've already got that on board. You know, they don't have to think about that. They just naturally do it and they naturally know to do it. Where that's something I had to learn. And really only after making kind of a fool of myself for a few times before that, until I learned, right? Mm-hmm. So I think those are some of the areas where we have trouble, you know, reading body language, eye contact too. You know, people think you're being dishonest if you look away. They think you're shifty or hiding something. It's like, no, it's just, I don't want to bore into your, I don't want to feel like I'm staring at you, and I don't want to feel like I'm being stared at. So that, I think that can be kind of some, so just various, I think it really kind of distills down into, or boils down to, society's, the way society ticks versus the way we tick. Just kind of, there's a bit of a mismatch there. And both sides haven't quite identified the mismatch as much. And so there are misconceptions, I think, formed on both sides that kind of lead to difficulty, almost like an invisible Grand Canyon between myself and a neurotypical, a divide that is almost impossible to scale completely. Does that make sense?
Yeah. When we talk about relationships, do you feel that the neurotypicals look at us differently within the relationship because we carry our emotions on the outside?
You know, I think they do. I think they see us as vulnerable. I think we have to be very careful not to get exploited, not to reveal so much about ourselves, not to move too quickly. We're so eager. We've been so socially awkward and cut off from a lot of the world a lot of times, and barred from forming relationships or friendships. And so I think a lot of us find ourselves in the position of being so eager to form a friendship or a relationship that we often move too fast. We're too accepting. Sometimes we don't think critically as much as we should, and be like, oh, okay, wait, I don't know this person just yet. Let's take things slow. Let's, you know, so I think mm-hmm. we tend to do that a lot, and we tend to express our emotions, and it's so logical, right? You know, like I would love to be able to like walk up to a fellow adult and go, I like you. Want to be friends? Like we did when we were kids. It was such a straightforward way of making friendships. And when they said, sure, then okay, cool. We're now friends. You know, no one has to wonder, case closed. Yeah. As in adulthood, it's hard to make friends as a grown up, you know, because we're thinking we might like that person, but we're kind of doing this dance, wondering if, okay, should we meet for coffee? How do we get this off the ground? How do we carry this forward and through the process of making that friendship? Same thing with dating. You know, it's like, okay, that person seems to like me, but what do they like me for? Do they like me for mm-hmm. my body? Do they like me because they think I'm vulnerable and they want to exploit me? Do, you know, what's going on here? And so, or do they really actually like me for me? You know, it's hard to know and it's hard to tell. And so, yeah, the emotions, really, I've learned over the years to keep mine kind of guarded, to be very cautious. I have a lot of experience with dysfunctional relationships. And in fact, my entire adult life, I'm single now for the first time in 30 years. And and right now, it's like, I need to have that experience before I go dating again. I need to be single for a while and really get to know not just who I am, because I have a pretty good idea about that, but how I function, you know, how mm-hmm. I stand on my own two feet, and therefore what I can bring to a relationship without being dependent on that other person. I think that's dangerous, because we often do tend to be dependent on neurotypicals and whatnot to maybe speak for us, make phone calls for us, go to bat for us. I know that that's something that's a trap I fell into, and it proved to be pretty disastrous for me, actually. So there's a lot of trauma that mm-hmm. resulted from that. And last thing I'm going to do is repeat that. So I'm like, okay, let's take it, you know, nice and slow. And I do guard my emotions a lot more. And I'm like, okay, you know, yeah, I like you too. Let's see where this goes, you know, or, you know, kind of banter back and forth first, you know. And that's, so yeah, definitely.
Do you feel that for us having no filter is tough in the, when it comes to dating, because we say what's on our mind and people don't understand that?
I think so. I think so. I think neurotypicals, they're kind of used to being, okay, I'm going to be kind of undiplomatic here. Just very, I'm going to be not filtered here. I think neurotypicals by and large are used to being BS'd. And if you think, and I'm not saying this to slam neurotypicals in any way, the main thing, I think we're kind of used to being BS'd too, because if you think about it, you know, the way the world works, think about advertising, PR. There's like a whole lexicon that corporations use, you know, we're going to reach out, we're going to interface, we have a mission to provide this, that, the other. And there's like this whole corporate speak. And the, and then there's in advertisements, there's the fine print that they're saying something without coming out and saying it. Right. So there's just a lot of, I don't know, talking around something as, instead of talking about something. So talking about something would be addressing it directly. Talking around something is kind of risky because they're talking about it, that they're trying to convey information, but they're doing so indirectly that the message might get missed, and it opens things up for misunderstanding and whatnot. And we've seen, you know, some of this stuff go to court, you know, lawsuits. So consumers against companies because the companies didn't state something clearly enough and the consumer feels they were misled and yada, yada. So it happens fairly regularly. So I think that, yeah, but there still is like this whole like philosophy and culture around advertising even. And we're hit with an average of, I think I read a stat where it was like 3,000 or 3,300 ads per day or something like that. It's just insane. So, because they're everywhere. I mean, every website, every television, I mean, everywhere. They're on the backs of city buses. I mean, all of that. There are tons of ads everywhere. And we're almost immune to it. We're so used to it. And so companies, you know, they tell half truths. People have gotten used to telling half truths or talking around something. And so I think it's hard to come up with examples just because it's so ubiquitous. It's just sort of everywhere. And a lot of people, you know, if they see something that they don't like, they may or may not even say anything. So they may not criticize, they may just choose not to go there and open that can of worms. So I think that, yeah, I think that it's tough because when people like us come on the scene and we're straightforward, we're trying to help. You know, we might say, hey, that shirt really clashes. You know, it's not you. We're speaking from the bottoms of our hearts. We're really trying to help. We care about that person. We don't want them we don't want them to clash with their clothing. We don't want them to wear something that's unflattering to them. Or I'm just using that as an example. And so we, you know, we're going to point that out to try and protect them. But they're not used to that because nobody else does that. So when we do that, it's like, they're shocked and they're like, whoa, you know, they're trying to make sense of what just hit them. You know, oh, I mean, we do it as a matter of whatever. I mean, we do it with ourselves, our own self-talk. We do it with each other. I mean, it happens, but then, and we understand where we're coming from. So, you know, we're like, it's like that just doesn't fit you. Or I think, you know, I think that you're this way, but you could really be this way or whatever. We could say that to each other and take it in stride. A neurotypical kind of runs a greater risk of feeling more offended or taken off guard, taken aback, because they're not used to anyone bringing those things up. It's almost like it's a taboo to offer even constructive criticism. They even have a method for doing it. It's like the sandwich method. It's like praise, you know, first praise them, then offer constructive criticism, and then wrap it up with another praise again. You know, you almost have to like sandwich things. And that way works. I mean, all of us, I think, feel better when someone does that with us too, but it's way more, I think, of a requirement for neurotypicals in general than it is for people on the spectrum. Now, I understand that in answering all of these questions, I'm painting with a really broad brush. I don't mean to do that. There will be exceptions to the rule. I understand, you know, I'm not trying to speak for everybody, but, you know, I understand that not all of us operate the same way, either neurotypicals or spectrumites, and that's okay. But yeah, I'm speaking in these broad generalities that can kind of be dangerous. But so I just wanted to add that caveat. But yeah, I do. I see those differences.
Now, when those of us who get into a relationship, what are some of the things we should look for that are red flags to us to say, get out now before things get toxic and we get mistreated? Because I do know people mistreat us because we are vulnerable. We care way too much. We put our feelings on the outside, and I know people take advantage of it. So what kind of red flags can we look for?
I'm so glad you asked this question, because I've done some good research into that. Let me pull something up here. Bear with me for just a sec. Let's see. Okay, so let's see here. Go with flags. So I actually wrote some stuff up in preparation. Okay, so the first thing, some of the things, okay, so really it starts with dating. I mean, a lot of these red flags are visible early on, but only if you know what you're looking at. So, and a lot of us don't know what we're looking at. And unfortunately, they do not teach this stuff in K through 12. So you're about to get some information that is, it could potentially literally be life-saving. So, because some relationships do turn out deadly, worst case scenario, and I would not want that for anybody. No. So let's talk about that. I love this. Okay. So one of the red flags that you'll notice with some of these people, and not every one of these red flags has to be there. Mm-hmm. Even if you notice, but if you notice up and there are some of them that maybe they, if they're isolated and everything else is fine, and that's just that one red flag, okay, then it may not be a total deal breaker. But especially if you notice a pattern, and there are personality patterns involved in this, that's probably a different show. but in the getting to know you phase, they should ask about you. Mm-hmm. It should be a bi-directional exchange. You know, and they should listen when you tell them something about yourself. So,
so it's like a give and get.
Yes. Now, if they start getting, what's that?
I tell you something, you tell me something, and you're sharing. It should be a two-way road.
Exactly. A two-way road. And the thing too, is that they shouldn't get too personal too quick. If they start asking you like too many questions at first, that in itself is another red flag. So it's kind of hard, because if they ask you too few questions and too many, and it can be hard to gauge. And what is too few versus too many? That's even a harder question to answer, but if they start kind of asking you too many questions and not sharing anything about themselves, so either one of the extremes, and this is really more of an intuitive feeling. It just comes down, there's no easy answer other than to practice a lot of awareness, just be very present and think critically. And I wouldn't be paranoid, but definitely be skeptical of the other person. That other person has to earn your trust. And so definitely pay attention to the vibes that you're getting from that person. If something doesn't seem right, don't dismiss it. Don't write it off. Don't ignore it. Definitely pay attention to that, because that's your gut trying to tell you something. And that is so important. That's one of the major mistakes I made throughout the years, is not listening to my gut. So, and I just sort of dismissed and rationalized and justified, and don't do that. It's not a winning proposition for you ever to do that. So lying is another one. If they have to make up a story. So even if it's a little white lie that you find out later was false, that's kind of a clue, because there's a particular popular TV show that I watch where it's a talk show where the host says, for every rat you see, there are 50 you don't. So if they're lying about that one thing, what else are they lying about? And you always have to almost be suspicious sometimes. Let's see. Especially if it's all about them and they don't seem to care very much or seek your opinion or your input about where you might want to have dinner on your date or what time. You know, if they're just sort of dictatorial, like, okay, I'll pick you up at 8. Well, now, wait a minute. Were you going to solicit my opinion on this? You know, if they are on social media a lot, and especially if they complain about being banned from social media, fairly often, that means that they're on there saying like, well, nowadays that doesn't really matter because there are other reasons for being banned on social media. But one of the reasons for being banned on social media is picking fights, bullying, making inflammatory comments, and trolling and whatnot. And that was me. That was largely like pre-2020 or so. After 2020, things changed. And so, I mean, that may or may not be valid anymore, the social media part. But let's see here. Also watched for too much negativity. I knew someone once that, you know, it's like their day was either like soup, like their day either sucked because it was super stressful or whatever, or it was boring. It's like, well, no, wait a minute. If it was super stressful because you're busy, then a slower, quieter day would be more pleasant, right? I mean, mm-hmm. but everything was negativity. So there's that. Let's see. Also in relationships. So that, I mean, and that those can actually be the red flags I've covered thus far are kind of ones that you may notice during friendships too. And so the during relationships, when you text, okay, so here's one: when you're texting with them, and they start showering you with compliments, and they barely know you. Like, oh, you're so beautiful, or you're so amazing, or whatever. It's like, how do you know that? Unless you talked with me or you know me, like, but they'll get in right away. It's called love bombing. They start love bombing you. They compliment you every, and they have pet names for you and lots of terms of endearment, and they love you so much. Okay. And they're coming on a little strong. That's like, okay. You know, that's someone, a lot of times, those are people that are buttering you up. And once they have you, that is going to drop and you're going to wonder, it's like a switch that gets flipped and they go cold and flat. And you wonder where that lovey, warm person is that you fell in love with. You're like, okay, why can't you did that before? Why can't you keep doing that? Why can't you do that again? What? And you start to wonder if you did something wrong to make them mad or to bore them or whatever. So you start wondering. And I think that those of us on the spectrum are even more likely to do that because, you know, everything, a lot of us have been the black sheep in our family and mm-hmm. a lot of stuff has been our fault. And it was we who failed to be, you know, properly socialized, or, you know, we were the failures in the social situation. And so in a relationship, that's double tricky because you have someone that preys on your vulnerability because they can tell. So they come in and they figure, ah, here's someone I can exploit. Here's someone I can have on my arm. Here's someone I can use. And so I will basically love bond them. They don't know what hit them. It feels like a fairy tale. It's too good to be true. You know, it's this ideal whirlwind romance. And they start moving too fast. They start wanting to move in with you. They start wanting to go study. They even get engaged in a matter of months instead of years, right? But they want to do way too much too fast. And it moves too rapidly. It's too rapid a progress. So that's definitely those are a whole bunch of red flags kind of in one bullet point. Another red flag, and this is more subtle, when you're texting with them, like let's say, you know, you're apart for the evening doing your own thing and you're texting with them. It's like you text them and let's say that you have the same kind of phone. So it gives you like a read receipt, i.e. you know, when they, you know, when it's been delivered and you know, when they read it kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Some phones do this. Well, if their phone gets read receipts and you text them and they read it and you know that they read it at 10:36, but then they read it right away, but then they don't respond for like 4 minutes. You know what I mean? And they kind of interrupt. And so the texting rhythm is kind of uneven, unless you know that they're doing something where their replies are going to be spotty. Like, but if they're just sitting on the couch and you know, they're like watching the game or watching TV or something like that, mm-hmm. you know that they could respond a little bit. You know, especially if this happens for a long period of time, it's kind of weird. It's one of those things that it's like this little tiny subtle thing that you take notice of, you file in the back. It's not necessarily a red flag just yet, but file it in the back of your mind because chance, especially if you know they're a fast texter, like the replies come. So it's kind of weird. You'll text them, they'll read it right away. They won't respond for 4 or 5 minutes, but when they do, it's fast because they're a really good fast texter. Well, it's because they're texting multiple people usually. So it's, I mean, nothing's ever good enough for some of those people. So, yeah. It's
sort of like when you're talking to like a tech support agent on chat.
Yes.
And they respond to you for the first time. And then for their second response, it's like, it takes them like 5 minutes or 2 minutes. And you're wondering, wait a minute, Am I the only one you're talking to, or are you talking to multiple people at the same time?
Exactly. And they usually are. Yeah. Because they're trying to just maximize their stable of people that they can use. They're kind of like energy vampires. They're sucking off people's energy. So that's what they're doing. And they're doing that to you too. That's pretty much all you are to people like that. Another red flag is like intense anger that just pops up out of nowhere. Especially too, if it turns right back off as soon as things go their way again. So little tiny things can just make them irate instantly. But then as soon as things start going their way again, it's like, oh, okay. And it's like, people don't normally just flip their emotions on and off like that. I know I have a very long fuse. I have some things that are triggers that are a little bit quicker, but I know what those are and I'm good at communicating those to people so that they understand what my triggers are and we can avoid them. But other than that, I have a lot of patience and a long fuse. So it takes me a while to get to the point where, okay, I'm angry. It really does. And then once I get angry and blow my top, it takes me a while to calm back down again. That's normal. These people, it's a switch, and it's an over-exaggerated, you know, irrationally irate reaction to something pretty trivial, like their phone rings and it's a coworker. Oh my God, you know, they go, or, you know, this would happen to my now late husband as well. Just like someone would call and they'd need a schedule change and he wouldn't get irate at them, but it was, and that's what's interesting. He didn't get irate at them, but after he put, you know, put the phone down, I was like, rah, rah, rah. It's like, really? So, holding grudges forever is another one. Times when you feel you can do nothing right, like, and everything's always your fault. There's black and white thinking is kind of another one, especially too if they're super judgmental of entire groups of people, like racism or homophobia or something like that, or they're prejudiced against lower income people or something like that. That's a red flag. Let's see, what else? Vanity is another one. So if they're like overly concerned with their physical appearance and whatnot. Laziness is another one. So just stuff like that. Anytime where they kind of brag about gaming the system or getting ahead or pulling some trick over people, they call that a duper's delight, where they're duping people and they're taking delight in that. That's a big one. So you're looking for basically too much too fast. You're looking, so yeah, to summarize, you're looking for stuff like too much too fast. You're looking for emotions that switch on and off. You're looking for, you know, kind of like a vibe of compulsion, like they're compulsive about something. Like maybe they binge drink, or they use drugs, or they're promiscuous, or they date a lot of people at once. They're unfaithful, that sort of thing. There's a compulsion there, or they buy stuff or they hoard money, and they're always weird about money. That may not be readily apparent, but if you get into a relationship with one of these people, a lot of them also want control. And the control isn't always as obvious as you can't have a, you know, I'm going to keep your cell phone, I'm going to keep your car keys, and you have to come to me for either one of those, and I'm going to give you an allowance, and that's all you can use all week. And it's not always that obvious. Those are like the textbook types of control. I was under severe control, but it was extremely subtle. I'll describe, especially when it came to online banking, I was never voluntarily given logins and passwords. I had to nag. I said, can you please get me this information? Cause I don't have it and I'd like to be able to do it. Okay. And they agreed, like that. They said, okay, but then they never did it. And, you know, we're busy and stuff. So I forget about it and they let me forget about it. And a week would go by, or 2 weeks or something like that. Hey, I never got those logins and passwords. Can I have them? Yeah. Okay. I'll get them for you here in a minute. I'm busy right now. Okay. And, you know, lather, rinse, repeat. Finally, like I remember I was the driver for the two of us, and I basically, and he couldn't drive. And I hated having to use that to my advantage. But at one point, this was like the fourth or fifth time I asked for logins and passwords to the bank accounts. And I said, I need those logins and passwords. I asked for them like a month and a half ago. Originally, I've been asking for them, and we're not leaving to the office today to go home until I have them. I actually had to do that. It turned me, like, his behavior turned me into something I I don't want to be. So whenever you have someone that's jacking you around like that, withholding information, withholding affection, withholding even sex if the relationship gets that far, withholding money, withholding whatever, right? Withholding their emotions or whatever, withholding their half of a discussion, anything like that, that is a deal-breaking red flag. And you need, and at that point, you need to get out. You need to get out. So, especially if you feel like they're not listening to you, they kind of like zone out and stare and whatnot. And, or they have like listening comprehension issues, or they try and take your words and twist them back on you. And, well, you said this. Well, actually, no, I didn't. It was this. If you're feeling the need to have to record a conversation, that's a red flag. And these kind of crop up over time. So I kind of started answering this question with like earlier, almost friendship-like, then progressing to early dating. And now it's like when you're getting into the relationship where you've pooled your finances and, you know, stuff like that, it's like, yeah, that is a big, big issue. When people start pointing out to like your mutual friends, or even your parents who you've now taken to meet them, or to meet your new partner, if they say, I've got some reservations about that person, listen to that. It's so easy to get defensive and go, oh, he's not that bad a guy. You know, he's just misunderstood and this and that. And, you know, or they're this way because of this, that's something that's beyond their control. And we should actually like feel for them, as we want to believe the best about people. So we're going to rationalize and write stuff off. But really, you've got these outsiders. A lot of times there's a such thing as being so close to something or someone that we kind of fail to see. Like if we hold our hand up in front of our face, we don't really see our hand all that clearly. We don't really see what this is. But as we kind of distance ourselves from it, it's like, oh, there's a hand there. You know, like if I hold my hand up to the camera, it's hard to tell, right? What this is. But if I, that's her hand, right? And so now you can see more clearly when you're further away from it. That's the kind of advantage that your friends, your close friends and your family can provide for you in seeing these relationships. When you're so close in this relationship, it's hard to know what you're seeing. But when a friend of mine came to stay with us for a couple of months, she pulled me aside while he was gone and said, look, you need to know something. You know, I've made some observations. I don't want to create issues in your marriage, but I feel I'm on team you. I'm your advocate. And I want you to at least be aware of things that you might not see. Because I was so used to it. But it didn't even faze me anymore. She said he's secretive. She said he's lazy. She said he will do anything. He will get what he wants, meaning he will do what he needs to do to get what he wants. You're not part of, in other words, you're not part of that equation, and he doesn't consider you, and he would resort to maybe some unethical type activities to get what he wants. And, you know, that's not cool. So yeah. And the secretive, yeah, he really did keep a lot to himself. Turns out she was so right. Mine was leading a double life. So an entirely double life. So it was, and it bordered on very, very frightening. I think the most taboo subjects that you can think of. And that's what I saw that he was involved in. So wow. Or getting involved in. Yeah. So I had actually filed for divorce, and I was going through divorce proceedings at the time. And I had been trapped. The only way that I was able to get free of that relationship was that I had some place to go and I had people who would support me. Otherwise I could not have made it on my own. And that's why I stayed as long as I did. So there's a lot. I have a long, long history, lots of experience, do more experience than I would wish on anybody.
Now, is there anything to look for us when we start dating? Is there things we should look for in the person that we want to date?
Yes. Ask yourself, do their actions match their words? Because anyone can dump a bunch of sweet words on you. Anyone can, mm-hmm. You know, levy compliments and this and that. But in the end, what do their actions say? So definitely that. Also look for kind of a, almost like a possessiveness, like not really possessiveness. It's going to be like a little bit possessive, you know, or jealousy. Look for jealousy and possessiveness, because with that, I mean, everyone's a little bit, but nobody should be too much that way early on, because the relationship isn't cemented just yet. You know, it's not, it's, and early on in a relationship, it's important to give each other space and leeway and kind of come together naturally. A person who wants you for themselves right now, right away, and kind of exercise. I mean, at first it's kind of cute that they're possessive. Oh, wow. You know, it's heartwarming. Oh, wow. They want me and they love me that much. And they're protective of me. That's another thing. They're protective. They're like, they're on the warpath against anyone who would harm a hair on your head. And wouldn't we all like that? I mean, that's what fairy tales are made of, you know, it's, and they live happily ever after, but life never goes according to the fairy tale. No. And I'm not sure the sequel to the fairy tale would go all that great either, because what happens after that is they get controlling. The possessiveness and jealousy turns to control. And pretty soon, not only can't you talk to your exes, you also can't talk, which could be understandable. I mean, that would be weird if you talk to your exes too many. That is actually another red flag, is they talk to too many of their exes, especially if you can't talk to yours. It's like hypocrisy is a red flag. And talking to too many of their exes too often is kind of a red flag too. But also, you know, it escalates beyond that. Now you can't talk to your friends. You can't, that are opposite gender. Now you can't talk to your friends who are same gender. Now you can't talk to your family, and it gets, and they try and isolate you more and more and more. Another red flag is that they try and dominate your life, and they try and like plan your day for you. It's like, okay, we'll do this, that, the other, you know, and they're, and they kind of, pretty soon you have like no life outside them, and you realize, holy crap, it's been a month and I haven't even called my best friend or my mom or whatever. And I used to call them every week, and we used to get together every week for lunch and stuff like that. And you haven't, because your life has been basically monopolized by this one person. And that one person hasn't basically said, you, the right answer is that other person should be telling you, hey, I know you've got friends and family. Why don't you go out with them and we'll get together in a couple of days? You know, that way you maintain your life and all the friendships and bonding ties that are, that of people that are close to you, things that are important to you. You maintain your hobbies and your separate identity as a person, because you have a life outside of me. And let's get together, you know, maybe a few times a week or once a week or whatever, instead of every waking moment of every day. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it kind of does. I mean, so what do we do if we're in that sort of relationship and we want out? What are some things they can do?
I always say prevention is the best cure. So if you can spot these warning signs early on and say, you know what, I'm just getting some nagging feelings, I'm going to look elsewhere and kind of say a polite goodbye to this person, hope they take that hint, hope they take it well. But if it gets far in, all I can say is maintain your identity. Have a source of income that is just your own, that other person, that your partner does not have access to. Don't let yourself be controlled. Do not let yourself be possessed. If they are financially irresponsible, or even if not, I mean, don't pool all your finances together. That's a big one, because financial abuse is really rampant in dysfunctional relationships. And financial abuse is basically, it has kind of a broad definition, but basically it's the, it can be anything from lying about money to being irresponsible with money to going into debt or opening credit cards in your name and running up debts in your name, stealing your identity to do so, kind of thing, because they know your social security number. They know all of your information. They know the answers to all your security questions because they know you that well. That's a really big problem. And also using like withholding financial information or withholding money itself from you. So make sure that you never, ever completely pool all your finances with someone. I used to be a big proponent of, hey, if we're married, what's mine is yours, what's yours is mine, and it all ought to be, you know, combined together, because, you know, it's a marriage. It's a, you're coming together. Otherwise it's kind of weird if you have your own separate accounts. Now I completely understand the need for separate accounts. You can have a joint one to pay bills, but then have separate ones for your own spending money. It just seems to be that much more harmonious. That way you've got a little nest egg that you can have set aside that has only your name on it. You can will it to them upon your death or something, but like name them the beneficiary should you die. But while you're alive, that nest egg is yours in case you need to make an exit, in case you make discoveries about them that they're into this or that, and like happened to me almost 2 years ago, and you need to make an exit. See, I didn't have that exit. What I did have, and here's another thing you can do, is to maintain a strong support system outside of this relationship. So this needs to be like either with your parents or siblings, aunts, uncles, cousins, friends, neighbors, have people who have your back, who could let you come stay with them if it got that bad, you know, and you have a roof over your head and food in your stomach. And that is very important. A lot of people don't have that. And that's what keeps them stuck in these marriages. I was stuck for 8 years longer than I wanted to be because I didn't have anywhere to go. I didn't feel I could go live with my parents because I thought they would take his side. I didn't have any friends who were local here that I could come stay with. That just wasn't possible. So I had no choice and I had no money that was all my own that I could start over, that I could use to start over with somewhere else. So I was kind of stuck. And I was stuck at least until a friend did move here. And that's my roommate that you saw when we were talking before the show. It's basically said, you can come live with me, no rent, no strings attached, no expiration date on that, just open-ended, stay here as long as you want while you get, you know. And turns out we're actually pretty harmonious household at this point. You know, we like to spend a lot of time together. There's no relationship there. And both of us are cool with that. It's more like a spirit sibling kind of thing, you know? So it'd be like, it would almost feel incestuous or something if we were, I don't know. I don't mean to offend anyone with the use of that word, but I think, you know what I mean? It would feel weird if we got into some kind of relationship. So we decided, yeah, we're very close, but that's about as far as it gets. And right now that's like my favorite type of relationship. It's like, okay, this is cool. This is fine. It's harmless. I do me, he does him, we're fine, you know? And so I think, yeah, and it was, I credit him for being the reason that I could leave my husband and file for divorce, because it was actually at the point where I literally had to, like I had no choice. I couldn't afford to, but I had to. I couldn't afford not to. And that was even stronger because of what I had discovered he was into. Or might have been into, was getting into. Let's put it that way.
Do you feel that the autistic, those of us who are on the spectrum, should date only on the spectrum, those of us who are on the spectrum, or should we branch out and take the chance and finding someone who's an NT who kind of matches our own personality?
I think it's okay to branch. I think it's, you know, I think dating someone on the spectrum, it makes things easier in some ways and harder in other ways. We're different, so we're not necessarily going to have the same strengths and same weaknesses, but so it's not necessarily going to be redundant. But I also know that, okay, I mean, if social awkwardness is a thing, you know, one of us may be more socially awkward than the other. And so you can really, you know, rely on each other for strengths and weaknesses and stuff like that. And obviously it makes things a little easier in that you kind of understand, okay, the idea that someone can get overwhelmed or peopled out and socially exhausted and need to come home and reset. And you're not going to look at each other funny for doing that or for saying that you need that. You're also not going to take offense when you're blunt with each other, straightforward with each other, because you know that there's no malice, you know, intended. You know that there's not, you're not trying to be mean to each other. You're just saying the way, and no one gets up bent out of shape about it. So that's pretty cool. Routines, you know, if both of you are into routines and things like that, it can work very, very well. We have several good routines in our household that work very well for us, even though, you know, we're not romantically involved. You know, we do have a household together and we are very effective cohabitants of that household. So I think, yeah, I mean, there's a lot that, you know, I guess I'll use my roommate as an example, even though we're not, you know, going out together or anything. It's like we understand each other on a certain level that, okay, we each have our special interests. And I understand that, you know, he's into his clocks and his guitar and his IndyCar and his bagpipes, you know, and whatnot. Just like I'm into my biochemistry and my economics and my music and, you know, whatnot. So we understand, whereas with a neurotypical, we might have to kind of explain, hey, you know, I have an intense interest in this and it's not an obsession. And I'm like, I already know that his aren't obsessions and he knows that mine aren't obsessions either. So there's a lot of stuff that we don't have to, that we on the spectrum typically don't have to explain to each other because we're already living that and we already get it. Whereas neurotypicals, it's like we almost need to come with an instruction manual. Mm-hmm. No, the special interest is not an obsession, and no, we're not nuts, and no, it's not something we have to throttle back on because we're doing it too much. We're not addicted to it, you know, that sort of thing. And no, we're not being rude when we're being straightforward. And yeah, we do get peopled out, you know, so I might only be able to run a few errands a day, you know, or something like that. And there comes a point in time where it's like, I'm exhausted and I don't need someone looking at me like I'm from Mars going, okay, we just went to three places. Why are you exhausted? I'm like, because that was three crowded places, you know, that's out and about for too long, too many exposure to too many people. It's like, and I'd have to explain that to them. So there are pros and cons, right? So when two spectrumites are dating together, there's a lot that is a common shared understanding. When it's a mixed partnership, you know, spectrum versus neurotypical, there might need to be more explanation, more self-expression. This is why I do this. This is what I need. And this is why, so that they understand, because we're often blamed for not being able to empathize. We lack empathy, right? We're not able to empathize with them. Mm-hmm. Guess what? That goes both ways. They can't empathize with us either. Empathy is just being able to put yourself in someone else's shoes. We might not be able to do that with them. Okay, fine, because we're not neurotypical. We don't know how they tick, but guess what? They can't put themselves in our shoes either. So that lack of empathy really isn't a trait for us. It's because when we get together as fellow spectrumites, that social awkwardness and that lack of empathy goes away, because we can kind of put ourselves in each other's shoes a little bit. We get it, you know? So now there are some potential pros, though, of a mixed relationship, and that could be that you each have different strengths and different weaknesses that you can rely on each other for. Like, I often relied on my very neurotypical husband to, can you make this phone call for me? Can you go to, I'm having trouble with this clientele or with this, you know, apartment management or something. Can you go to bat for us? You know, and he'd do the dirty work. Or maybe we had hired someone in our business that wasn't panning out and I needed them to go, but I didn't, you know, due to my social awkwardness and my extreme kind of insecurity at the time, I needed him to do that dirty work for me. And it feels very, very much like a cop-out, but it relieved my stress. You know, he had no problem doing that. And whereas I would have. So, and meanwhile, you know, I had the hyper-focus and whatnot in the family. So we really had two different ways of looking at the world, which kind of, we were able to combine those resources and that, you know, and he was able to then kind of be my neurotypical liaison to a neurotypical dominant world. And that really helped me a lot. You know, he kind of helped to, I mean, he wasn't all bad, right? You know, he had some really good traits as well. And so, and he did a lot of things for me when he was alive. So he would definitely, you know, say, no, you need to do, he'd explain things to me. No, you need to do this in order to function in the world, kind of thing. You know, I'm paraphrasing here, but he would help me in that way. Mm-hmm. Whereas a fellow spectrumite might not know to do that because they're struggling with some similar things that I'm struggling with, if that makes sense. And so we might be kind of like too blind leading the blind sometimes. I don't know. So it's, I think any scenario is possible. And I think that we really do kind of need to just find out what's best for us. There are some, that there is the potential for healthy versus unhealthy in either configuration. And there are exploiters in both neurotypes. There are toxic people in both neurotypes, and that can be a real issue. And in fact, it's very, very common. The narcissistic personality traits, largely the ones I described throughout the show today, they comprise, people with an overabundance of those traits comprise an estimated 25 to 30% of the population, and 80% are male. So that does kind of, but that also means that 20% are female or thereabouts. And again, these are estimates because we really don't know for sure, but that is a real, that's something definitely to think about. And I don't know what the breakdown is between neurotypical and on the spectrum as far as those personality traits. So those personality disorders, I don't know. That would be an interesting experiment, to be some interesting data to collect. But I think, I think honestly, there are some very spectrum friendly neurotypicals out there. And so I think we shouldn't necessarily write off a whole group necessarily, unless you really just know yourself that well and say, you know what, I know that I only want to be with someone on the spectrum. you know, and either way, that's okay. You know, just always look for toxic personalities in either case, because you don't want to get wrapped up in one of those. And they can coexist. The spectrum mm-hmm. and being toxic can coexist in the same person. It's, I don't know that it's super common, but it happens. So yeah, I've seen it in both males and females. It's kind of icky. Yeah. And I'm talking males and females on the spectrum. I've seen these disorders and it's like, oh boy. Yeah. It's like, okay, I'll stay away from that person. At that, it was a really painful lesson that I learned back on social media in some of the spectrum groups where I thought, hey, you're on the spectrum, I'm on the spectrum, therefore we're automatically going to agree. We're automatically going to get along and we can automatically be friends. And that is so not the case. And I got burned really hard and it hurt really bad. So now I know that just because they're on a spectrum doesn't mean that they make a great friend. I mean, that's not the only qualifier, right? So, yeah.
Yeah, I feel you there. I mean, I've been kicked out of numerous autism groups because people may not know it. I'm very much of a confrontationalist. I'm very opinionated. I say what I feel and I don't hold back.
Yeah.
And I mean, one of the things that's always bugged me in these groups are these parents that come in and shove their kids in their faces, like, oh, my kid's so smart, he helped me program this, blah, 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 blah. Or my kid's going off to school, blah, blah, blah. I just wanted to say, oh yeah, well, I graduated from the University of England in Canterbury, England, and I've traveled across Europe, which is your kid done. And then you get the stupid people who think autism is something that you get from a vaccine or something like this. And the parents are so backwards, they blame everybody. They don't trust the CDC, and then you just get into arguments over that.
I would love, you know, that is such a good topic right there. I would love to possibly do a show on that sometime because I have a theory on all of that. I've done a lot of research into that realm and I think you're onto something. I would love to schmooze about that at some point. That'd be another, we could do a whole show on it if you wanted to.
But why do you think we have so much trouble in the dating world? I mean, do you feel that the neurotypicals out there are just too afraid to approach us or even get into a relationship because we are so different?
Yeah, I think they may look at us and go, well, they're weird, but maybe endearingly so, or maybe we're just too weird for them. Kind of depending, I guess. They're used to kind of, like they're used to being able to meet someone and being able to satisfy certain expectations from that person that we may or may not match. I think that we may have trouble in the dating world because really when you're starting to date someone or when you're starting to look for a partner, you're basically putting yourself out there. Mm-hmm. You're kind of marketing yourself and you're also kind of shopping. You know, this is kind of the way, especially online. I would absolutely caution, as much as we like to do things online from the safety of our own homes and sanctuaries, I say be very, very careful online. A lot of people who date online are some of these disordered personalities that will use you and exploit you and hurt you, and they won't care. They are totally devoid of any shame, remorse, empathy. They're cold and they're calculating. And it's a very empty, painful place to be. These people cause a lot of damage in a very short period of time. So I would be very careful dating online. In fact, I probably won't date online anymore. I met my husband online and I have not started dating. I don't have any plans to really start dating. If and when I do, I definitely want it to be more grassroots in person. It doesn't mean that you can't get swept up by mm-hmm. these jokers in person, but at least you have the body language and stuff and the intuition and whatnot. You can kind of form, do you feel safe or not around this person? You're not just looking at words on a screen in a profile picture that may or may not be real. Mm-hmm. Details might have been filled in that might be fake, you know? So it's the online world is rampant with that stuff. And it's much easier to pull one over on somebody online. So I would be very cautious. I would almost say try not to date online. I would also say that you know, but anyway, kind of back to the question, you know, you're putting yourself out there, and we're not necessarily great at marketing ourselves. We just are the way we are. And we kind of take that for granted. We've spent a lot of time alone. And so we're very familiar with ourselves. We're very in tune with ourselves. And I think that, you know, we're kind of, so how do we package that for someone else? How do we explain ourselves to someone else? How do we help someone get to know us? That can be an issue. I think that too, our social cues, you know, someone might be getting bored or restless or something like that, and we may not know to stop talking, or we may not know when it's their turn and we accidentally interrupt them. I know I do that all the time. Mm-hmm. And I'm always embarrassed when I do, but I'm like, okay, how do I, and I don't know how to stop doing that. I mean, I really don't. So, or things that we're experts on that we want to share that knowledge. We're not trying to show off, just want to share that knowledge. In the neurotypical world, we may come across like a know-it-all and stuff like that. Or when we're very precise, they may think, oh, well, they're pedantic, or, you know, anal retentive or overkill or something like that. So, and when we're trying to be logical or rational, they figure you're black and white thinking. So it's, yeah, I mean, we do have a lot of challenges. Mainly it boils down to sort of a mismatch, you know, between the way we're wired and the way we think and operate, and the way they're wired and the way they think and operate. And it's kind of like you have these two separate islands that need a bridge formed between them. You know, they need roads, they need flyovers, they need pathways built between them so that we can cross those bridges into each other's world, and we can meet somewhere in the middle. We can explain to them the way we are. We can ask them to explain stuff to us. If it looks like we're not getting it, if it's not coming naturally to us, or we're kind of clueless or something, then we can do that, I think. And a cool neurotypical will totally make that effort, you know. They'll be like, yeah, sure. You know, if they're into you and they have compassion, then they will. But yeah, I think it makes us, you know, I think there's so much mud around the word autism. It's so muddy. What does it even mean? Sometimes even we can't agree on what it means. The healthcare professionals can't agree on what it means. There's so much. It's a really loaded term. So I think that most people, especially neurotypicals, but also many within our own community, see autism and being autistic as a disability, being disabled. I won't call it a mental or cognitive disability. There's nothing wrong with our personalities or our intelligence. I think it's mainly a social disability, if anything, because of social awkwardness, but that's my opinion. And that's just speaking for a true, pure, you know, just being on the spectrum. I understand that there are other people that have like co-occurring conditions like epilepsy and things where it becomes a physical issue as well. But I don't think that that's inherently part of autism, because not everybody on the spectrum has those conditions, those associated conditions. So, I think there's just so much misunderstanding going on between people on the spectrum and people off the spectrum. I think there's so much misunderstanding of the term autistic and what it even means. And so I think that it just really, we have a hard time, you know, I mean, and to disclose or not to disclose. And if so, when? I mean, I'm sure you have to at some point, you know, not too late into the relationship, but maybe not on the first date either, right? So
that was my question, is when do you tell somebody in a relationship, hey, I'm on the spectrum, or I have ADHD, or I'm just neurodivergent? When do you divulge that information? I mean, you don't want to tell. I mean, I remember on a dating app, I told this girl we were talking with, hey, I have ADHD and ASD. And she's like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to end it right here. My ex-husband and both my kid have ADHD, and I don't want to go down that road again. It was a mess.
Yep. And that's painful, because that's rejection based on who you are. And rejection is always painful, especially if it's personal rejection. And I am so sorry that happened to you, because that is, it's not cool. I mean, I understand where they're coming from, but it's not cool to be on the receiving end of that. I would honestly, if that's the way somebody responds, then you know they're not the right one for you, because they're not going to, you would not want to enter into a relationship with someone. And at least you know that early on. So at least when that happened, it stunk that that happened, but at least you knew early on before you got too invested, before you had too much history together, before you really started to like her too much and started to envision much of a future with her and this and that, at least you knew. And so you already know that, okay, she's not open. She's not neurodiversity friendly. And we absolutely need someone who is, and we have the right to say, okay, cool, have a nice day. I'm going to go find someone who is, because there are plenty of fish in the sea. So it's not just about that one person. The rejection stings in the interim, but just know that, okay, that's, according to my philosophy, that's the universe doing you a favor kind of thing. Just a clean exit of this person out of your life, because they were never going to be healthy for you. If they already have a bunch of ADHD in their life and they already have a negative attitude toward it, you deserve better than to be in a relationship with that person. Because that a relationship with that person is never going to be happy for you, and maybe not for her either. So it's actually okay that you knew up front. At least she was straight up with you. And kudos to you for being straight up with her. So I'm not sure I'd mention it on the first date, but I might mention it. I don't know. See, it's hard because it depends too on how you meet. You know, what's your first contact? Are you emailing for a while back and forth? You know, I mean, is this an internet date where you're emailing for a while back and forth before meeting in person? Or is it like is it a blind date your friend set you up on? Or is it just someone you happen to meet, bump into, and, oh, you know, get to talking and, hey, want to go for coffee, you know? And so I think each situation is going to be different, and it's something you got to play by ear and do the best you can. That's probably the best answer, because I don't think there really is a right time, like a perfect time or a required time. I do know that it's probably good to disclose before you get too far into the relationship. Make sure that make sure they haven't proposed yet, for sure. Also, you know what I mean? Or ask you to move in with them or whatever, and make sure they're not doing any of that too early anyway. But that's, you know, and it's maybe not so much when is how you do it. So, and this is a little tricky. It takes a little finessing and a little playing by ear, a little improv. So you want to see if the conversation, if you can maybe subtly steer the conversation. I mean, subtle here, kind of around too, you know, hey, I have this interest in psychology and I've been studying this lately. It just sort of fascinates me. You know, what do you know about this, you know, autism spectrum or whatever? And let them tell you, because if they're biased against it, or if they're like bigoted about it, then you know that they're probably not right for you. But that way you can put the feelers out first before you even disclose. I have come out as being on the spectrum to a few of my patients. And it was always received well, but I did it very carefully, because here's the deal. Disclosing is a risk. You risk rejection. You know, it sucks. You risk rejection, because there are a lot of preconceived notions. There are lots of misconceptions. There are lots of myths flying around out there. And so people will have their biases. Some people will be like, oh no, I'm so sorry. And it's like, don't be, I'm not, you know? And other people will be like, oh, I can't be friends with you then. Okay, fine. Bye. you know, so it's always a risk. And that's always anxiety inducing. Second, it's kind of like, so there's no undo button. Once that cat's out of the bag, it's out. Once they know, they know, and you can't take that back and rewind and go, okay, let me do that again. Only this time I won't disclose. No, once they know, they know. And so, and that's sort of unnerving. So so you have to be real careful about it. So what I did was the thing is that these were patients that I was pretty convinced were on the spectrum, just having read through their paperwork and observing them and things like that. And I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a therapist of any kind, but I knew, because I'm on the spectrum too. And so when I saw these people in practice, you know, they would be accompanied by their spouses, of course. And so I'd be talking with both of them and I'd be like, hey, you know, so at first was like, I call it things like sensory sensitivity or whatever it is that matched what they were, you know, the traits they were describing to me. And then I asked, you know, like, what do you know about Asperger's, or what do you know about the autism spectrum? And you do have more and more people who know and or suspect that they have those traits. So it's becoming less mm-hmm. of a taboo, yeah. less of a curse, you know, it's mm-hmm. less of a bad thing.
That's one of the things I've noticed is more and more people are coming out later in life mm-hmm. on the spectrum.
Yeah.
I mean, you see celebrities nowadays coming out saying, oh, yeah, I'm on the spectrum. I mean, Amy Schumer came out with saying her husband's on the spectrum.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. I have a patient on deck for Monday that knows that they have ADHD and spectrum traits, and so does their dad. And so they were able to not only see it themselves, but also their dad, so they know.
I mean, my best friend... I thought was on the spectrum, and he was going, he said, you know, I'm going to get tested. I'm like, okay. So he came back and says, the doctor says, I'm not on the spectrum, but I do have ADHD.
Okay.
I'm like, are you sure you're not on the spectrum? Because you do have some of the spectrum traits.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was talking with another friend who is on the spectrum. He's like, yeah, you can have some of the traits, but not be on the spectrum, which is a shock to me.
Yeah, it's a continuum. So it's kind of like, it's almost like, what is your, it'd be interesting to kind of, for everybody to know, you know, like what their, I mean, a lot of people know what their blood pressure is or their glucose, their average glucose, right? I mean, a lot of people know some of their numbers. It'd be neat to come up with like a neurodiversity scale score kind of thing, like maybe 1 to 100, you know, or like 0 is like really like extreme neurotypical, and like 100 would be spectrum. And most people are going to fall somewhere in the middle. Mm-hmm. And I guess the closer you are to the lower you are on the on this continuum, the more neurotypical you are, the closer to that, the other end, the more strongly on the spectrum, you know, the more strong your spectrum traits. And it would just be neat for people to kind of know that number.
Yeah.
So that, you know, I don't know. It would just be fun, because that way it would at least respect the fact and highlight the fact that we all fall somewhere along a continuum. I mean, I guess the potential pitfall is that people would be like, well, I'm more or less than you. And, you know, other people might be like, you know, we don't want anyone working for us that's over 50 on that score. But, you know, I mean, so it could probably open up to all kinds of problems, but it would be neat if we could at least trust our society to use these numbers ethically. It'd be neat to foster understanding. Because it's like, oh, you're a 20. Well, no wonder. And I'm an 80. So, well, no wonder, you know, you see me as this way. I mean, okay, cool. So I don't know. It's just, it could be a discriminatory tool. So that could be bad, but it could also foster some understanding. I don't know. Just sort of a brain fart I had.
I mean, one of the things I didn't realize was there were levels in the spectrum. There's 1, 2, and 3. I never knew about that. Until recently, I start getting emails from Quora, and almost every other question I see, the first question I see in my email is something about the autism.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, why are so many people asking questions about autism? And then I'm looking at the person who's answering it, and it says so-and-so level so-and-so.
Uh-huh, okay.
Like, oh, there's levels. And then I asked my friend, he's like, yeah, there's 3 different levels
mm-hmm.
of autism.
I forgot about that. Yeah.
He's like, there is where you need very minimal help, there is where you need some help, and then there's where you need severe help.
Yep. Very true. Very true. I know I'll have to go within the next 5 minutes or so, if that's okay. I've got to meet a friend for dinner. But yeah. Wow.
Excellent. So anyway, it was fun talking with you again, Lara, and let's do this again.
Yeah, let's. Absolutely. I'd love to do something on the autism versus vaccines versus what, you know, the spectrum. And that'd be kind of fun. I don't know. I'm just, as an idea, if you're interested. Right.
Well, see you on the next one, everybody.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Not a problem. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Reed. Take care of you.
You too.
The way things used to be, I'm no big fan of now. I must have some sweeter memories somewhere in the cloud. Welcome miss all you used to be. Gonna miss all you had. Consigned to the dustbins of history, like opinions from your dad. You can talk to the freaks. You can talk to just about anybody you happen to meet. It ain't what it was, and it is what it is.